Let's go.
It's on.
Now it's on. Now it's on. Be careful what you say. I wanted to go through a couple of loose ends in the first half of Yehoshua. We finished Perek Yudbet, or we looked at Perek Yudbet last week. And we sort of looked at it from I call it the bird's eye view, which and really is not a lot more to say about Perek Yudbet, except a couple of items. Perek Yudbet is this summary of the entire first half of the conquest of Canaan, and it reads like a list of, as we said, it reads like a military march. It reads like a shira, like a song of victory, but it reads also like a march. And you have this listing of the kings: Melech Yericho Echad, Melech Ha'ay Echad, Melech Yishalayim Echad, Melech Hebron Echad. It reads like a march. And what we had suggested was that, in fact, this is just that. It's a shira, it's a song of victory, it's a song of thanksgiving. It's a summary of, in very poetic terms, of the entire Congress. It serves several purposes. Obviously, it serves one purpose, which is to express hodah, or thanksgiving. And we'll come back to that issue in a moment. It serves a purpose of dividing Sefer Yehoshua into two parts. Because clearly, if we are summarizing the entire conquest, then we have reached a certain dividing line between one part. We still have half the Sefer to go, but the second half of the Sefer will be very different from the first half. So this Perek, which lists 31 kings that Yehoshua and the people conquered, serves as a kind of demarcation between part A and part B, between the first half and the second half, which Chazal talk about in terms of a division of time, 7 years and 7 years. Chazal talk about the 7 years of conquest and the 7 years of inheritance or dividing, right? 7 years of kibush and 7 years of nachla. And that essentially is a reflection also of this division, whether it's exactly 7 years in each half, whether the time frame is equal to the two halves of the Sefer, is open to debate, but certainly this perek serves as that transition between one half and the other. The Perek has a certain problematic character to it, and we started to address this question last week. It is just that. It's a summary of the kings. It's a shira, but it is missing some very important components that shira must usually have. Namely, I think most importantly, is as a shira, it's missing the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's missing God in this list. It says, "Ela Malchei Haaretz Asher Hikai Yehoshua Uvnei Yisrael Be'ever HaYarden." These are the kings of Israel that were smitten and conquered by Yehoshua and Bnei Yisrael. There is no reference to God in this entire shira, and that's enormously problematic. You have to ask yourself, I can't believe that from that perspective, I don't believe that Yehoshua is in the driver's seat with the Shira. This sounds more like it's coming from the populace, from the people. And then you have to ask the questions to the what's it doing in Tanakh. Like, so what's it doing here? Unless it's to tell us that there's something already going awry, something's already not right, which we will see in more detail as the second half of the Sefer opens up and we begin to realize all the problems. It's almost as if the two halves of the Sefer are everything that we've done up until now, for the most part, with one or two minor glitches, has been pristine, perfect, according to plan, God-driven, Yehoshua and the people. There's a give and take. It's almost as if everything goes right. And then as the second half of the Sefer begins, suddenly everything's wrong. Suddenly we find ourselves, just take a look at the opening verse of Perek Yud Gimel, and you'll see it, you'll hear it right away. Yehoshua Zaken Baba Yamim. Yeshua is old. If it describes somebody as old, means essentially that they are no longer able to function in this regard. Vayomer Hashem Elav Atazakanta. God says to him, "You are old." In other words, that's not an accident. That's the theme here. Yeshua is at the end of his life. Yeshua is no longer able to function in the leadership role that he has had till now. But v'ha'aretz nishara harbei me'od l'mishta. But the land still remains, for the most part, uninhabited and unconquered. Which means that Yeshua, your job is still, on the one hand, unfinished, and on the other hand, you're too old and no longer able to do to finish the job that was necessary. So we have this opening statement of Perek Yud Gimel, which sets a tone for the whole rest of the Sefer, that something's gone wrong. And whereas the Sefer never tells us what went wrong, we can begin to pinpoint perhaps some of the issues in this transition Perek. Perek Yud Bet, which is this Shira that is such a strange Shira in so many ways. That's number one. And that also, we sort of touched on that at the end of the Shira last week, although we didn't get into great elaboration on it, but I wanted to put it into context. It's a very disappointing end to what was such a magnificent run of Yeshua's conquest of the land of Canaan. You sort of get this almost majestic song of conclusion and victory. And yet when you look beneath the surface, it's missing some very important components of it, and it sets a different tone to it. That's number one. Number two, there is a broader issue that this Shira raises. And that is not related specifically to Yeshua, but in the broader context, a topic that's much larger than we're going to do it justice and do it here in an hour, but the question of what has been called typically rejoicing at the fall of our enemies. You sing Shira at the conquest of your enemies. Philosophically, theologically, is that the appropriate response to the victory against our enemies? It's a very complex issue, and it touches on a number of halachic areas, halal, and philosophical approach to events in history. There's a famous joke that went around the internet a couple of years ago about the definition of every Jewish holiday. The definition of every Jewish holiday: they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. That definition. And that's somewhat problematic. You have Purim, which is certainly a celebration of the victory over Haman and his forces. You have Pesach, which is celebrating the Makot of Mitzrayim and the destruction of Egypt and the plagues of Egypt and the drowning of the Egyptian army beneath the sea.
But that's
what I wanted to address. Yes and no. That's the ambivalence that's reflected in the halacha. Mm-hmm. So take a look at the source pages that I've given you. I'll show you some very interesting things that may surprise us, maybe not, but we're going to look at that. There are all kinds of them. I mean, this is really, so Pesach is really the focus of this discussion more perhaps than here. We're kind of just going to touch upon it briefly. But there's those components to it, and we'll see. Let's start here, which is, as you said, the theme that runs through Pesach of, as the pasuk, based on the pasuk in Mishlei Binfol Oyivcha Al Tismach, do not rejoice over the fall of your enemies, which is the basis of this whole discussion, and as it's formulated in the halacha, if you take a look in source number one, which is the Beit Yosef, the base of Beit Yosef states, Shibole Alakat Katav, B'Shem Midrash Harninu, Parashat Sukkah, in the name of a Medrash, Shehatam She'en Gomim Ha'alel Kol Yemei HaPesach, the reason we don't recite full halal, as Debbie said before, Hu Lefi She'nitbu'u HaMitzri'im, because the Egyptians drowned, and says, do not rejoice over the fall of your enemies. The problem with this position of the Beit Yosef is twofold. Number one, it contradicts a Gemara. And I forgot to put the Gemara on the page, so you'll forgive me, but I'll tell you what it says. The Gemara asks the question of why there's full Hallel on all the days of Sukkot and half Hallel on Pesach. And the Gemara gives an answer which is very different from this Beit Yosef. The answer that the Gemara gives is that on Sukkot, every day of the holiday has a different set of korbanot. And because they have a different set of korbanot for the Chag, a different korban musaf, therefore each day is like a new Chag and mandates therefore a complete Hallel. Whereas Pesach, after the first day of the Chag, the musaf that's given every day of the rest of the Chag is exactly the same as it was on the first day. And therefore, since there isn't a new Korban, it's not a new Chag in that respect, it's a continuation of the same of the old Chag, and therefore full Hallel is only on the first day. So the Gemara raises exactly this question, and the Gemara seems to give an answer which is completely independent and completely relevant to this question of our enemies and the destruction of our enemies. Furthermore, if you think about what the Medrash is suggesting, the Medrash is suggesting that the reason we say half Hallel is because we don't want to celebrate the fall of our enemies. How many died at Kriyat Yam Suf? Thousands. Right? Egyptians. Soldiers. How many died in Makat Bucharot? A lot more. Many more than the soldiers. Every firstborn of every household died in Makat Bucharot. In Kriyat Yam Suf, the army was destroyed. So, which is the greater tragedy and loss of human life? Makat Bucharot or Kriyat Yam Suf? Makat Bucharot. And yet at the Seder we say full Hallel. The first days of Pesach we say full Hallel. In fact, Seder night is the only night of the year we say Hallel at the Seder and full Hallel. So the suggestion that we say half Hallel because we want to somehow feel sorry for our enemies who tried to destroy us and we beat them, and therefore our hearts pang for our enemies who tried to kill us, is somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, we say yes, we don't want to rejoice that we half Hallel because we don't want to rejoice at the fall of our enemies. On the other hand, Makat Bucharot, Leil Mitzrayim, we're saying full Hallel with gusto, and more Egyptians are dying there than they are at Kriyat Yam Suf. That's one challenge. Second of all, specifically with regards to the question of whether or not we are allowed to rejoice over the fall of our enemies, there are contradictory sources. So the same source that we saw, the same kind of midrashic source that identifies this half hollow because of Benfola Yivchal Al Tismach, when it comes to Purim, the Medrash takes a completely opposite tact. Right? Purim is all about celebrating over the fall of our enemies. We don't say Hallel on Purim for other reasons unrelated to this issue, but we have the Day of Simcha, and we have Mishloach Manot, and we have Asuras HaChag, and there's certainly no mitigation of the celebration on Purim on the basis of not to rejoice over the fall of our enemies. In fact, if you take a look at source number two,
also tying in this Hallel to the Karbanot.
In other words, that's part of this contradiction.
Tying that in.
That's part of this contradiction. In other words, if I ask the question, why do we say half Hallel on Pesach? One source says because we don't want to rejoice for the fall of our enemies. On the other hand, we have other sources that give completely other reasons for it, unrelated to this issue, because the issue itself is open to some ambivalence. Do we or don't we rejoice if our enemies, hell-bent on our destruction, are destroyed before we are? It's a difficult concept. Somebody who is clearly an enemy of the Jewish people, you know, would we have pangs of remorse over the loss of life of Nazis? No. So Benfola Yivchal Tismach is a very, very strange concept. I have a little book. I actually didn't think of bringing it. Didn't think it was appropriate to quote Mad Magazine in the context of a Shir in Tanakh. But there's a book published by Mad Magazine in 1972. It's called My Friend God. Have you ever seen it? I'm not even sure I should put this on tape. I'll do it anyway.
Turn it off.
Nah, it's all right. Have you ever heard of one of the authors of Mad Magazine is a guy by the name of Dave Berg. He wrote a whole series of books, typical Mad Magazine stuff. Dave Berg looks at the lighter side of kind of things. He had a whole series of them. Somehow, somewhere or another, along the way, he wrote a book called My Friend God. He's a Jewish guy, Jewish comedian, all Jewish comedians. Wrote this book called My Friend God, and it's all about Judaism. It's all about Judaism, cultural Judaism, jokes about Judaism. It's very interesting. It's a mixture of jokes and very profound insight. He has the comments that are just precious. Some of them are no longer politically correct, so you have to be careful what you quote. But it's really remarkable. You know, you laugh, and then you sit there and you go, wow, kind of thing. It's a very interesting book. It's very hard to get hold of because it lasted in print for a total of 6 months. I think it was very controversial, actually. Especially his chapter on Israel, which was mind-boggling and controversial. So he has in there a piece about how Jews are not allowed to rejoice at the fall of our enemies. He quotes this piece and he says, you know, Jews are not allowed to rejoice at the fall of your enemies. And then he says, now you know why we're called blank damn Jews. Because we can't even rejoice over the fall of our enemies. And so he says, okay, God. He has this whole running dialogue with God, my friend God. He has this line in the book where he says, if I want to do something, I ask God. I ask my friend whose name is God. If he doesn't say no, then I know that I can't. Okay, God, you win. I will not openly rejoice over the fall of my enemies. I too will, I won't, like the Japanese yelling banzai and you know, I will do like the Israeli soldiers who after the victory go out and vomit and regurgitate because they're disgusted by it. And then he writes at the end, but when the regurgitation is over, I applaud so hard my hands are raw. That's how he concludes this piece, where he says that after the regurgitation is over, I applaud so hard my hands are raw. Because it's a concept which is a hard one to swallow. Can't rejoice over the fall of our enemies. And when our enemies are Nazi killers, you want to celebrate. I remember the day the Gulf War ended in 1991. We were living in Israel at the time. And it ended Erev Purim. It ended Erev Purim, and the next day, which was Purim, they had waited another 24 hours after the end of the war before they could tell us, before they told us to remove the plastic seals in the rooms. And so it was a mixture of Purim and the end of the war. And you could have, the dancing that was going on in the streets was palpable. We were walking around, and we were living in Shalvim at the time, we were walking around pulling off all this plastic of the rooms with the gas masks in hand and literally dancing in the streets. So where's the bin fall of Yivchal Tismach? You know, don't rejoice of the fall of your enemies. Is it humanly possible? Is it rational? And this is the ambivalence. On one hand, we have this concept in Mishlei, and on the other hand, we have contradictory sources. So in the context of Purim, for example, sorry to mix Mad Magazine and Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, but the Lahavdil, nonetheless, in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, he has a story in the context of Purim, which is the exact opposite connotation. There's a midrashic background to the relationship between Mordechai and Haman, where there's soldiers in Achashverosh's army, and they're in the middle of the desert, and one is dying, and the other saves his life, and he swears to him that he'll give him provisions, he'll give him water, but only if he promises that he'll be his slave, and he writes on the bottom of his shoe, Mordechai writes on the bottom of his shoe that Haman is now his slave. You ever heard this story? That's why we stomp, that's why we write Haman on the bottom of our shoes and stomp on it, because it comes from that story. So in the context there, in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, the story has the following piece to it. Amar alei urechob al sus, he says to him, to Mordechai, get up on the horse. Amar lo minui hatzom ein bi koach lalot urechob al sus. So Mordechai says, because of the exhaustion, I don't have the strength to get up on the horse. Ma'asa Haman. Haman, who at this point is now Mordechai's servant, what does he do? He shpil et atzmo v'natan Mordechai raglo al tzavaro v'alav rachav al asus. He put Haman on the floor like a footstool, and he stood on his neck, and he got up on the horse by standing on Mordechai's back. And the Medrash says that as he got up, he gave him a kick. Amar lo Haman. So Haman said to him, I skipped a line. Amar lo Haman, v'halo katub b'torah bin folo yivchal tismach. Gave him a kick as he got up. He gave him a good, kick with his foot. So Haman says to him, Mordechai, how can you do that? Doesn't it say in your Torah, do not rejoice over the fall of your enemies? Evidently, Haman knew Mishle. So Haman responds, sorry, Mordechai responds and says, Amar lo Rasha, b'Yisrael ketuvze. That's only referring to Jewish enemies, as if we have Jewish enemies. Aval b'umot ha'olam, but when it comes to our enemies of the nations of the world, there are different verses applicable. Ve'atal b'amotenu tidroch. You will tread upon their high places. So here, even in the terminology of the Medrash, you have this ambivalence. You have this notion that, on the one hand, the Medrash that says V'hala we say half, the Pesach we say half hala because we don't rejoice in the fall of our enemies. On the other hand, in the context of Purim, you have the Medrash that says no, that's not true. When it comes to the enemies of the world who want to destroy us, their destruction is a cause for great celebration. If you have a Jewish enemy, meaning somebody within amongst your people who tries to do you harm, then their taka, if you are victorious, if you win, you lose. Because when you set brother against brother, even if one wins, they lose. So there I understand, bin folo yivchal tismach. Whereas when you're coming to, on a national scale, nation against nation, where one nation wants to destroy another, there the victory is completely appropriate. Victory is completely appropriate. So there's, this ambivalence I think is reflected a little bit in the question as to what this parak is doing. What is the purpose of this parak? Is it really to sing song over the victory of our enemies, and is that appropriate? It's even, I'll go one step further, even in the question of Shira, what's often quoted in the context of Pesach, that we don't say full hallel because we don't want to rejoice over the fall of enemies, is that you can't sing Shira, the Malachim were not allowed to sing Shira at Kriyat Yamsuf. It's Gemara that says the Malachim were not allowed to sing Shira at Kriyat Yamsuf. And that's the next two sources that I gave you are also this kind of almost ambivalence or two sides to the question of whether or not the notion of Shira, of song, as a song of thanksgiving or a song of victory is appropriate when it comes on the heels of such great loss of life. So, for example, in Shmot Rabbah, actually, let's do the Gemara in Sanhedrin first. Source number 4. Amar Rabbi Acha bar Chanina, the pasuk says, "Be'avod v'sha'im rina." When the wicked are destroyed, you shall sing. To which the Gemara interprets this to mean, "Be'avod Achav ben Omri rina." When kings, evil kings, wicked kings, idolatrous kings like Achav fall, we should rejoice. So the Gemara raises this question, is God happy when the wicked fall? Doesn't it say, verse states that when the enemy went out before God, it says, Hodul Hashem ki lilam chazdo, give acknowledgement to God because God is merciful for eternity. And there it doesn't say kitov. Normally it says Hodul Hashem kitov. Thank God for He is good. Here the word kitov is missing. And the Gemara explains the reason why the word kitov is missing here in the context of this battle is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't rejoice when the enemies fall. What does it mean when it says that in the Kriyat Yamsuf context, we go back to the story of Kriyat Yamsuf, that the two camps, the Israelites and the Egyptians, could not approach each other all night long? So the Medrash, the Gemara applies that phrase not only to the camp of Israel and Egypt, but also to the Malachim. At that time, the ministering angels wanted to sing Shira to God for the events of that were unfolding. Kadosh Baruch Hu said to him, "The creation of my hand are falling in the sea, and you are going to sing a shira." So from here, again, I go back to this ambivalence between the two sides of the equation. And here you see that the Ribono Shel Olam says to the Malachim that they can't sing Shira because God's creations are being destroyed. On the other hand, the same Medrash, in the same context of Kriyat Yamsuf, in source number 3, says that the Malachim wanted to sing Shira. Second line, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bikshu HaMalachim Lomar Shira Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bota HaLayla. That night when Bnei Yisrael were going through the sea, the angels wanted to sing Shira. Fourth line, Amar Lahem, Ligyonotai Netunim Batzara V'Atem Omim Lefanai Shira. My soldiers, my army, my legions are in trouble, and you want to sing Shira? And that's why it says, V'lo Karav Zeh Azeh Kol HaLayla. He wouldn't let them. It's essentially a pun. The word Zeh El Zeh, which in the Pasuk is referring to the two camps of Israel, also is used to describe the angels singing Kedusha to God every day. Kadosh, 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 we said in Kedusha. So by the pun here is by taking the phrase V'lo Karav Zeh El Zeh, God did not let the angels go one to another to say Shira the way they normally do on a daily basis. V'Karav Zeh El Zeh V'Amar. But the moment Israel emerged from the sea, God, the angels came to God and they wanted to sing Shira to God. Kadosh Baruch Hu responded and said, "Yekadmu banai tchila. My children will sing Shira first." That's why it says, "Az yashir Moshe." Moshe will sing first. Then you can sing Shira. So you have the same issue, same question, same event, two different midrashic sources painting opposite pictures over what the response should be. One medrash in the Gemara is saying that the angels didn't sing Shira. Why not? Because Masei Adai Tfuim Bayam, the creation of God's hands are drowning in the sea. How can you sing Shira? The other source saying, the angels wanted to sing Shira before the Jewish people were saved. And God said, "My people are in trouble. How can you sing Shira? It's not a time of Shira." The moment they were victorious, they wanted to come sing Shira. And God said, "Wait, Israel sing Shira first because they were the ones who were saved. Then you can sing Shira." So not only are the Malachim allowed to sing Shira in that context, they have to wait for Bnei Israel to sing Shira because we are entitled to do so first. We were the ones who were saved. We are first in line to be entitled to sing Shira over the fall of our enemies. So there's this constant ambivalence in all the sources related to this question over, do we have the right to rejoice over the fall of our enemies? And the sources contradict each other. They present the same events and the same circumstances from opposite perspectives. And I think the contradiction is not an accident. I think it's a reflection of the ambivalence that we feel over this issue. On the one hand, we were saved, and these were enemies who wanted to destroy us. These were evil people, and we want to dance in the streets. And on the other hand, when we look at the broader picture of God's creation, it's a sad event when human beings have to be destroyed because they're evil. It's good because they're evil, and evil is destroyed. It's bad because we don't want any human being to be evil and therefore need to be destroyed. So you have this constant ambivalence in this issue. I think that it's one of the most it's a problem till today. It's a problem till today. I don't think this ambivalence has ever been resolved. And what ends up happening in these kinds of cases is that people so that's an interesting question. And I've actually heard both sides. Right? Mm-hmm. Not so much in terms of the Shoah, but in terms of, for example, the question of...
It's only pointing to the Shoah.
No, but I'm saying, even in the context of the Shoah, you'll hear different people respond differently to the question of who's not so much responsible, but where the let's just as an example take Poland or Ukraine. The attitude of the Poles and the Ukrainians were all a bunch of anti-Semites, and it couldn't have happened unless every Pole and every Ukrainian was an anti-Semite to the core, and therefore. On the other hand, there are those who say it was the Nazis and it was the Germans, and there were good people there, and there were good people amongst the people, and you have to acknowledge that, and you have to. In other words, there's at every level there's an ambivalence as to how broad you paint the brush.
When you stand at Babi Yar and it's in the middle of the city, there is no way all of those people didn't know what was going on.
And I can tell you, I've spoken to people who say, you know what? Our focus should be on the Nazis and on the Germans and even within the Germans on only those who perpetrated. But why should we blame the whole population and the whole culture? It's the whole society. It's not, you know, it was the people who did it. It wasn't everybody else. I've heard both arguments. Whether I reasonably, rationally agree to either side is not the issue. But I think that we. The whole notion, for example, this year of the Yom HaShoah, the whole theme of this year's Yom HaShoah community commemoration, which was to honor the righteous Gentiles, was to tell story after story after story about how good some of the rank and file of the people of Europe were. And they were. And they were. But does that not create that very same ambivalence? Do you come away with I came away from the Yom HaShoah program with exactly this ambivalence. You know, on the one hand, we're talking about the Shoah, we're talking about the Nazis, and you want to feel that visceral hatred towards the enemies who tried to destroy you. On the other hand, here you spend 2 hours listening to stories about how good the countryside, the people in the countryside were. So, what are you
talking there? Only about a small percentage.
But that's so. The whole program was designed to highlight those numbers. Right? What's the message you come away with? What's the political message you want to create?
Well, that depends how you want to refer this to this.
But that's
exactly my point.
But Adina, you do have this ambivalence because at Yad Vashem, why do you have a whole thing where you honor the non-Jewish righteous?
But I think it's actually a reflection of the same kind of ambivalence which we feel, and I think is legitimate. I'm not suggesting that it's we have to solve this ambivalence. I think it's real. I think this tension exists. It exists in the sources. It exists in our hearts and our minds. And I think it's part of the challenge we have. For example, the whole set with the going back to the question of the morality of Sefer Yehoshua, which always comes up every once in a while, the morality of conquest. It's hard for us to understand what was going on really in terms of the nature of the Canaanites and who they were and what they were and what the conquest of Canaan was all about. But there's certainly every once in a while we have these pangs of feeling sorry for the poor Canaanites who got stepped over and walked over, even though there's certainly another side to it. So I think it's a very interesting way to transition between these two halves of the Sefer. They have this moment of song, of thanksgiving, of a military march, of a shira, and at the very same time, it in and of itself is enormously problematic. There's no acknowledgement of God. Suddenly, they're being too arrogant. Suddenly, they're taking credit for themselves. Suddenly, they're just rejoicing over the fall of their enemies for no good reason. The tension, I think, is reflected in the two halves of this Shira. On the one hand, the context that presents it as this great military victory of Yehoshua and the people, and on the other hand, when you start to dig deep, the fact that it's missing something so substantial, I think reflects this very same ambivalence.
It's the human condition.
Absolutely. It is the human condition.
Do you think the Shoah can stand apart?
That's a philosophical question, a very good and a very powerful philosophical question. I think that from a theological perspective, the answer would be no. I don't think that the Shoah would stand apart theologically from the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, from the exile of our people. I think that theologically we see all of the catastrophes that happen to us in exile as part of the condition of being in exile. One can argue that within the framework of the experiences we underwent in exile, the Shoah was proportionately greater than any other. Even that, however, is debatable. My father has a book on 16th century Poland, and in there he goes through the story and the numbers of the Chmielnicki massacres. And there's the numbers are unclear, but if the numbers as presented traditionally are accurate, then the same proportion of European Jewry was wiped out in the Chmielnicki massacres as were wiped out in the Shoah. Just the numbers in absolute terms was much greater. Where I think the Shoah stands theologically different than the rest is Dafka not in its intensity, its magnitude, or its experience of exile. I think where it stands theologically different is in its connection to the rebirth of the State of Israel. Because what I think it marks was a turning point in that whole trajectory of history. From the Churban to the Shoah, I see history, Jewish history going in one direction. From the Shoah now back through the establishment of the State of Israel and forward, I see the trajectory turning around. Take a long time till we get there, but I think that that's, to my mind, the most significant theological uniqueness to the Shoah, is that I see it as the turning point of Jewish history in this regard.
I mean, that helps me, you know, in the sense that, you know, I guess that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah. I don't know how we digress to... to this one, I said you better. Okay, what I'd like to do in the remaining time is begin to take a look at. Is it still cold?
Yes. Oh no, I just
at 10 o'clock. It gets colder.
Yeah. I feel like it's.
No, it doesn't.
No,
it doesn't
yet,
start
it's
off
colder
cold.
Because you're sitting there.
I don't think it's
colder.
It's at 74. If I make it any. Okay, I have another sheet for you. All right, so that's it. That's one. Let's just take one and pass them around. After everything you said and done about this perek and all of its ambivalence and discussion about shira and not shira, etc., we have to come back to what the actual perek actually says. So let me come back to the text for a moment and just do a brief overview of what this perek reflects. Some of the lessons, some of the textual issues we should pay attention to in this perek. Perek Yudbet. Starting with Pasuk Zayin, the text lists geographic regions in the land of Israel and kings that were part of this conquest of Canaan. So sometimes we don't, I think it's important just to stop for a moment and look at a map so we understand what the text is telling us before. Maybe we should have done this before we interpreted the parak, but we didn't, so we'll do it afterwards. The Elam Malchei Ha'aretz Asher Hikah Yehoshua Bnei Yisrael Be'Ever HaYarden Yama. This is the story of the west side of the Jordan. The first paragraph of this parak dealt with the east side of the Jordan. Now we're dealing with the west side. Mibalgad to Bikat Levanon, from Balgad all the way in the north, in the valley of Levanon. The Ad Hahar Hechalak Ha'oles Seira, all the way down to the mountain of Seir. And God gave the land to Yeshua Actually, it doesn't even say God. Vayitnah Yehoshua l'shiftei Yisrael Yerusha. And Yehoshua gave this land to the people as an inheritance according to their divisions. That's a reference already to the next half of the Sefer we'll come to. What are the regions? Bahar, Ubashvela, Ba'arava, Ba'ashedot, Ba'midbar, Ufanegev, Achiti, Ha'emori, Ha'knani, Ha'pizi, Ha'chidi, Ba'yevusi. The regions that are mentioned in this pasuk are regions that are not necessarily the regions we today identify in the land in Israel. So I give you a map. There are two maps here. One is a list of cities. We'll come to them in a moment. And the other is a list of regions. If you look at the side that has the list of regions, these are the regions mentioned in this pasuk. Har HaLevanon in the north. Bik'at Levanon is the Jordan Valley in the transition today between the Jordan and the Golan Heights, if you will, or Syria. You have then, as you go down further, where it says Eretz HaEmek. This is Emek Yisrael. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Right southwest of the Kinneret. Then you go down further, you have Har Yehuda, Hashvet, reading from right to left, which is always appropriate in Hebrew. Har Yehuda, Hashvela, and Chofayam. The Shvela is the foothills of the mountain. So if you look at Israel topographically from a sliced picture this way, if you look at Israel topographically this way, and you look at it, and you slice off a piece of the mountain across, east to west, what Israel looks like is this. Go through the middle of the country and you slice horizontally, what you get is the following. You actually, that's, let me do that again. That's more accurate. Okay? This is the Jordan Valley leading up to the Dead Sea. That's why I had the chart reversed before. Did anybody notice why?
Yes, yeah, she did.
Because the Dead Sea is lower than the coast. I had it reversed. Okay, so this is Yam HaMelech. Let's argue for a moment. And then you have, it's not quite that steep, but then you have the climb up to Hare Yehuda, and then as you come down towards the coast. So this area here is called the Shvela. It's the foothill. And then the area here is the coast. This area here is called the Arava.
So this is totally good. This is not right. You're doing it backwards.
Right. I'm doing it left to right.
Look at the map and it's back.
Okay. Just turn it around.
It's just the same drawing.
Just because it's the same drawing. It's just I can't draw right to left.
So I'll have to.
Okay.
You just reversed east and west. That's all.
Look at them like backwards. That's right the first time.
It was right the first time.
No, what?
Yes, it
was. Right. Arava. Har. Shvela. Okay. It's the same chart. It's just a mirror image.
Right.
All I wanted to point out was the fact that the Shvela, the Chof, and the Arava are all flat. But they refer to, in the topographical division of the land of Israel, east to west, they refer to different regions. Then you have the Negev, and...
even today, they refer to different.
Yeah, 100%.
What do you mean that's different?
We call them...
They call that list.
In if you listen to the news, to the weather reports, you'll get the Shvela, the Chof, and it's amazing to me that you can have as many
different
weather climates in a smaller space as you do. It's all a function of the topography. Now, another piece of information. Sorry for my lopsided mountain, but another piece of information is that when we refer to the Canaanite population in Israel. Our mountains aren't quite that high, and they're not as lopsided. But when we refer to the population living there, generally speaking, the Emori live in the mountain range, and the Canaanim live on the coasts. So when we refer to Eretz Canaan is a generic term for all the seven nations of Canaan. When we start to break them down, they divide into two major groups, the Canaanites and the Amorites. The Amorites are in the mountains, the Canaanites are on
the east and west
coast. Usually both coasts, usually both, or the plains, the flatlands, more so the coast than they do in the valley. More so the coast than in the valley. But some here too, for example, here in Emek Beit Shan. Why are the Canaanites here and the Amorites here? Has to do with many factors, including how each population developed and modes of defense. The Amorites developed modes of defense that were based on walled cities. The Canaanites developed mode of defense based on horses and chariots. Horses and chariots don't work in the plains, in the mountains. So the Canaanites here in the coast, you rely on horses and chariots. The Amorites in the mountains will, for the most part, live in walled cities. Yerushalayim, Hebron, etc. For the most part. So that division also has implication for where we conquered and where we didn't conquer. We'll see that in the second half of the Sefer, that when we got to the areas of the coast where you had all the Canaanites and their chariots, we found it a much more challenging task. Yoshua's wars, for the most part, almost all of them, are against the Amorites, not the Canaanites. Skirmishes here and there, but the majority, right? Chatzor Melech was a Canaanite, but for the most part, Yoshua is able, and the people are able, to maintain the control of the mountains far more easily than they are over the coast. They have better success with the Amorites than they do with the Canaanites. The orange is Israelite, the yellow is Canaanite. By the end of the conquest, the orange is Israelite, the yellow is Canaanite. If you notice, this map is almost a reversal of the modern map of Israel.
Did that make them different kind of people?
I don't know. I know that they have different... We know strategically how they were different. We don't know enough about the culture, or I don't know enough about the culture, I should say, to be able to tell you whether they had different religious practices. The Hittites that are referred to often are further north. The Hittites are in Lebanon and in what is today Turkey. Because Turkey is the ancient Hittite Empire. So the nations of Canaan actually refer to different geographic regions also. The Jebusites, for the most part, are in the area around Yerushalayim. So we talk about the Prizi, the Yebusi, the Girgashi, the Chivti, the Chivi, the Prizi, the Canaani. They're not just seven nations scattered throughout the land. They actually refer to the geographic regions in which they live. So the conquest takes on that character as well. And finally, the list of the 31 kings you will find on the map on the page, on the opposite page. Just, I'm not going to go through the names again. They are almost all here. You can see them divided essentially up into two major regions, namely if you looked at them above and you grouped the cities, what are the major areas geographically where these cities group?
South.
South of Beit El, right? And essentially south of Beit El and north of Tanach and Megiddo, Emek Yisrael. There's a few scattered in the middle, Tirzah, Tapuah, Hefer, Afek, but for the most part, south of Beit El, or Ai, and north of Emek Yisrael. There's a large gap in the middle. Can you see it geographically? See the large gap in the middle?
Is that because of the topography?
No, actually, I think it has something more to do with the story of Shechem. Do you remember way back when we talked about Shechem and how it is that Yeshua marches up to Shechem for the ceremony of Anhar Grizim and Har Evel, and is able to march back and There's no battles in the area. This whole region is empty of any kind of military battle, and yet it's certainly a region in which Yeshua functions freely, moves freely. For example, the battle in the north, Yeshua has to take his entire army and move them under the cover of darkness, in secret, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, all the way up north to the area of Chatzor, in order to battle the kings in the north. How does he get through this entire region without any battles, or under the cover of darkness? Why is it that in the list of the conquest of the 31 kings, they're all gathered either in the north or in the south, and yet Yeshua has free reign throughout the center of the country? And what we had suggested was that the local population of Shechem and its surroundings were actually, we had made several suggestions as to why that area was loyal to Israel. One goes all the way back to the story of Yaakov and Shechem and the brit that Yaakov made with the inhabitants of Shechem. And the other was what I would probably call the most creative novelty of our this course, which was the suggestion that there are local residents of the tribe of Menashe in that region from the days of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, from before the days of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, from the days of Yosef. Remember that whole discussion back at the beginning of last year? That the population of Ephraim and Menashe is here in the area of the Gilad and the area of Emek Yisrael already from the days of Ephraim, whose two sons died and his daughter went to Israel and built the cities of Beit Chalon, Elyon, Beit Chalon, Tachton, and the story of Menashe and the conquest of the Chavot Ya'ir and the Gilad. We talked about that, I don't want to rehash it all now, but the idea with that was that there were certain parts of the tribes of Ephraim and Menashe that had left Egypt much earlier and that had settled in this region and were waiting for the rest of the Jewish people to come. So that this region here around Shechem was, generally speaking, a region that was already loyal to us. It was already part of our circle of influence. We had used this to suggest why the ceremony on Har Gerizim and Har Eva was necessary, and why it was necessary to repeat the brit of the blessings and curses twice, once in Avot Moav and once in Shechem. And the suggestion was because there were groups that were missing at Har Sinai. There was Shevet Menashe on the east side of the Jordan who weren't at Har Sinai, and there was Shevet Ephraim on the west side of the Jordan who weren't at Har Sinai. So they needed to reenact that ceremony twice more.
Why weren't the ones on the east side there?
Menashe is up here in the Bashan.
But when did he go there?
In the days of Yaakov. Yaakov's grandson is Ya'ir ben Menashe.
Okay.
And Gilad ben Menashe. So that concept, which we had talked about last year, also explains... Sorry, did I miss something? And that concept also explains why there are virtually no battles in the middle of the country. Now, the two major campaigns outside of Jericho and Ai, the two major campaigns that Yeshua fights are Giv'on south and Chatzor in the region of the north. In the center, there's nothing. He marches freely in and out, up to Shechem, back from Shechem to Gilgal, etc. That is... that's the map. Any questions? Okay. Which means we turn our attention to Perek Yud Gimel. Actually, we're gonna need this map with the regions, so keep that handy. I'm gonna read through beginning of Perek Yud Gimel. Now as we begin our look at Perek Yud at Gimel forward, we are not going to do the rest of Sefer Yeshua in sequence, nor are we going to do it word for word. The way I planned this class was to learn through the first 12 prakim, pasuk by pasuk. The second half, which is from Perek Yud Gimel through Perek Chaf, we're going to do in broad overview. A lot of it's lists of names of cities. And so that's hard to to do. It's also very technical. It's much more fun if you're marching through parts of the land and you can say, okay, here's this and here's that. When you're looking at a map, it's much harder and much drier. So what I want to do is we'll look at sections and the structure of the whole piece. The actual names of the cities and the borders and the boundaries I'm going to skip a little bit.
And how many more weeks do we have?
That's a good question. That's a good question. My calculation, I'm going to put this on pause for a minute. Okay,
can I ask one other question about that? I know you said this, but I just forgot.
It's okay.
In terms of conquering all the different kings, how many years did you say they took?
So Chazal say it took seven.
Seven.
It doesn't actually tell us. Chazal have a calculation, and it's based on a number of the textual sources, that the entire story of Sefer Yeshua takes place over 14 years. Seven for the first half, up the Perek Yudbet, and seven for the second half, which we're going to look at now. It's arguable that it could have, from a textual point of view, that it could have taken longer, because the notion of Yeshua Zaken,
that's what I was
going to ask. He is not a young man. If you think about it, Yeshua is 40 about. He's a generation younger, so he's, I don't remember, somewhere I once, he's 40 at Yitzhak Mitzrayim. So by the time Sefer Yeshua, remember, he's part of the spies, he's the Nasi of Shevet Ephraim. He's the representative of Shevet Ephraim when they leave Egypt, and they send the spies into the land of Israel. And I can't remember why or what source I have for the fact that he's 40 years old, but he's certainly in that range. 40 years later, at the beginning of the conquest, he's 80. If he's 40, right? If he's 40 when he starts, right? The only thing is that if he's 80 at the beginning of the Sefer, and it's 7 years later at 87, the suggestion that suddenly he's old because he's 87, whereas when he was 80 he was in full strength, is somewhat. He's certainly older than 20. He has to be older than 20 in Yitzhak Mitzrayim, because nobody under the age of 20 was included in the Gzeira. Right, so he had to be old. So the assumption is that he was I can't remember
how
why.
Long did
he dies at the age of 110. Am I right? Was am I confusing him with Yosef? No, Yosef dies at the age of 110. Yeshua. Yeah, 110. 110. Oh, so that's how I got the numbers. You figure it out. Work backwards. It's 110 when he dies. Chazal said this is a 14-year story, and so that puts him at around 40 at the time of Yitzhak Mitzrayim.
So when he says he's old, he's old.
But there is a big difference between 80 and 87.
I mean, that could be a bigger difference.
Wait, according to Chazal, at this point, he's 103.
Right.
According to Chazal, if this whole story is 14 years, so then he dies at 110, work your way backwards. Right? It's also possible that Chazal had 14 years between the entrance into the land of Israel and the end of the conquest, and then there's additional years between the end of the conquest and the time that Yeshua dies. Right? So that's also possible. So he's a little bit younger than 103. But nonetheless, certainly the idea being that his job is done. His task was to take Israel into the country as a national leader, as a nation with one unified army, one base camp situated in
Gilgal,
right? And from there to launch the campaign. And when it was over, now we're going to see the task that was left to the tribes, to divide them up by territory.
Do we, in many places in Tanakh, start by saying you are old, and therefore?
If it's if it's relevant to the story that's about to unfold, this is the message here is exactly that you are old. In other words,
right.
Therefore, you can't continue to do what you have been doing. What has to happen next is going to be different than what was before. That's the message.
It's pretty strong because it's repeated.
Right. First it tells us, Yeshua zaken ba bayamim, and then it tells us God said to Yeshua, Ata zakanta, hey Yeshua, your day is over. You can't do this anymore.
Okay,
you've got to leave it to the next generation. V'aretz But v'ha'aretz nishara harbe me'od l'rishta. The problem isn't so much that he's old. The problem is that there's still large swaths of land that are unconquered and unsettled.
And that's from what I keep remembering, is that was supposed to be a primary goal of his, to settle. That was
the goal that's set out now for the second half of the Sefer, which they do or don't do to different varying degrees of success. In other words, Yehoshua's first task is to take strategic control of the country.
Right,
but Yeshua can't settle the country. For that, you need the people to go out and settle the country. That's number one. Number two, the word l'rishta has two meanings in Tanakh. It means to inherit or to settle, a reshet. It also means to disinherit, meaning to conquer. So the term used in the Torah to conquer the land is v'horashtem et ha'aretz, which means you will create the land as a Yerusha for you. How? Right, there's already a people there. So in order to do that, you have to take one step further. So the term lehorish, lereshet is to inherit. Lehorish, which means both to cause to inherit to somebody else, is also the term used in the Torah for conquest. Which means that the land, he's saying is that the land has remained largely unconquered, not only unsettled. And the mandate certainly was to remove the nations of Canaan or to convert them, but to essentially convert them not to Judaism, but to the moral code of Shevet Mitzvot Bnei Noach, but certainly what was left was not yet completed. And then the Navi gives us a list of all those places that are yet unconquered. Zot ha'aretz ha'nish'eret. This is what's yet unconquered. This is what remains. Kol gulilot ha'plishtim v'chol ha'gshuri. The area of the plishtim and the gshuri. Gshuri is a reference down here to Eretz Plishtim. This area down in the south, southwest. Min ha'shichor asher pnei Mitzrayim v'ad gvul Ekron tzafona l'Kna'ani techashev, from Egypt, from Nachal Mitzrayim, down here, ad gvul Ekron, all the way up to Ekron, which is the city of the Canaanites. Here's Ekron up here. All of this is all Canaanite. L'Kna'ani techashev, chameshet tzanei plishtim, together with the five plishti cities, ha'azati, ha'ashdodi, ha'ashkoloni, ha'giti, ha'ekoni, v'ha'ivim. Five major plishta Philistine cities, Aza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gat, Ekron, and Mitaiman kol eretz haKna'ani uMa'ara asher laTzidonim ad Afeka ad Gvul haEmori. Mitaiman, west, all of the land of the Kna'ani, all the way up to Tzidon, ad Gvul haEmori. So we go up the coast. Once we get up to the north, the entire area of Lebanon, all the way up to here to the base of Har Chamon. Ad levochamat. Kol yoshvei ha'har min ha'Lebanon ad misufot mayim kol tzidonim anochi yorishem. All of this, essentially this whole swath of land, all the way up north, we'll talk about Emek Yisrael a little bit later, all the way up into here, and the area of the Bashan, all of the yellow, which was originally part of the boundaries of the land of Canaan, God says to Yeshua, the job's not finished. And that's the problem. His life essentially is coming to a close, his work is coming to a close, and the work's not finished. And so now what begins is a process in which he says to Yeshua, take the land, divide it by tribes. We'll see this next week. Give each section its territory, and then tell each tribe to go and take their territory. So that's what the Shem will look at next week.